It's a pleasure to be here. I'm sorry to only be here this week. But it's proving to be a very exciting time. So what I'd like to do is give a brief talk about some observations of turbulence in the solar wind, although the parameter range may not be the same as the galaxy. It does have the advantage that we can go out and measure it, and we can try to simulate some of its properties. So I'm going to describe both some observations and some puzzles about turbulence in the solar wind, and then a summary of some of our more recent attempts to understand these using simulations. Okay, a cast of characters, none of whom will take responsibility for all of this, and perhaps some won't take responsibility for any of it, but they have worked with us off and on for many years. And Neil Dean is responsible for the algorithm, some of the simulations I'll be showing. Sanjay Ghosh, Ron Ghosh, and Bill Matthews developed the spectral method codes. Venku Jayanti is the postdoc with us. Leon Hoffman knows more about solar physics than I do, so he gets to be on here. Aaron Roberts has been at Goddard for 10 years or more working with us. And Adolfo Vinas is also at Goddard. And Kit Wong and Ed Sirigar have worked on parts of the problem that I really won't discuss today, which is how you put together kinetic effects into fluid equations. All right. Okay, so the basic goal is to understand the development of turbulence in a spherically expanding solar wind, give some of the observations, talk about some of the previous work, and compare some of the simulations in expanding geometries to Cartesian geometries. In particular, we're interested in determining the power spectrum. So most of the results I'll show pertaining to the power spectrum are going to be of two dimensions at best, just because that way you can get enough resolution to get a power spectrum that has at least an approximate inertial range. And a question of what is the symmetry of the turbulence in the solar wind? This is a major puzzle. Even though we can go out and measure the magnetic fluctuations in the solar wind, virtually all the measurements to date have been done with single spacecraft in a supersonic flow, and you really only get a one-dimensional cut of the three-dimensional power spectrum. And this has raised some interesting puzzles in charged particle propagation as to just what the symmetries of the turbulent spectrum really are in three dimensions. And one possibility is that there's a large quasi-two-dimensional component, which looks like it's alphanic when you just do simple cross-solicities, but would scatter particles very differently. And I won't say anything about vortex streets, unless there's a public upwelling of interest. I think I may have taken the slides off. I don't know if they're here or not. Okay, so where does the solar wind come from? This is a false color photograph, an X-ray from the YOCO satellite, which shows this dark region called, appropriately, a coronal hole. And the contention is that certainly all of the fast solar wind comes from this region, and probably all of the slow solar wind also. And that the interesting part of the sun to a solar physicist is basically closed field lines that don't get out into the interplanetary medium and have very little to do with the solar wind unless there's a coronal mass ejection or a solar flare that blows material out through the closed field. But that the ambient free-flowing solar wind essentially comes from regions like this.
Is there an estimate of what fraction of the surface in the closed field line region might actually be open field lines? It could be 10% of that mid-latitude?
Well, it varies a lot with solar activity cycle. At solar minimum, much of the sun is coronal holes in the north and the south. And at solar maximum, it's so confused, and there's so many coronal mass ejections that it's difficult to say. It doesn't really matter. Yeah. Also true. Some of the models, one of which I'll refer to toward the end, which try to construct a solar wind self-consistently, starting with source surface maps of the magnetic field and then integrating outward out to 5 AU or so, can get self-consistently slow solar wind only from coronal holes, and that the closed field line regions apparently don't contribute or don't need to contribute, whether they do or not. We haven't been in close enough to find out. Recently, I don't know what that is, the Extreme Ultraviolet Imaging Telescope has made some interesting observations. If you combine YOCO with these EIT observations and Doppler measurements from the ultraviolet instrument, the SUMER instrument, what they found was a network of convection cells on the solar surface, and the blue-shifted regions are where it is hypothesized the fast solar wind comes from. But it's only the boundaries of these convection regions in the coronal holes. So it's not even the coronal holes. It's only the boundaries of convection regions. And this is an artist.
How do they know that?
Well, because those blue-shifted regions are the only regions where the gas is escaping. The red shift is going down. And the interpretation they constructed, this works.
But this is actually blue shift of the gas above the surface?
Yeah. So that's somebody's interpretation of what's going on. That's not real.
But these are the granulations. I mean, what's the granulation?
Super granulation.
Yeah, it's the magnetic carpet. This. So the contention is the only outward flowing gas is in these blue regions, and that's a Doppler shift. The red regions are downwellings.
So the red is supposed to be gas going down.
Yeah.
You mean gas at the center of the cell is going down?
Yeah.
But
above the cell.
Above
these.
This is not convection.
This is not convection. This is the magnetic carpet kind of thing. Yeah. And if you take flow from high latitudes and low latitudes that's fast, and you've got kind of closed loops in the center, what one finds is that the flow will come down toward the equatorial region if the magnetic field is not a perfect dipole, and it never is. You'll get a warped current sheet where the field changes sign, and if you map that out to large distances, and you're very inventive with Mathematica, as Randy Jacoby was for this Scientific American picture, you get a picture of a warped current sheet as the central region where the slow solar wind is concentrated and the fast wind is above and below this warped current sheet. All right, in order to understand some of the observations, we all have to sort of agree on what we're going to call things. The fundamental fluctuation of the magnetic and velocity fields, which is absolutely ubiquitous in the solar wind every time you look, and I'll show some examples in a moment, are Alphane waves, defined in three dimensions as magnetic fields plus or minus the vector velocity field, where the magnetic field is normalized to Alphane speed units by dividing by the square root of 4 pi times the mass density, and there's usually a 5% or so correction for helium, which is present in the ambient solar wind. It's convenient occasionally to use Elsasser variables, just because the wind is approximately incompressible in many ways, so Elsasser variables are kind of a convenient diagnostics. One of the more useful diagnostics is to compute the cross-helicity, the volume average of V dot B, but by taking its Fourier transform and integrating over the two directions transverse to the flow speed, get a reduced cross-helicity spectrum, whose integral is the total helicity, but more interestingly, it provides a measure, quantitative measure, of just how alphanic the fluctuations are. And one can do this in configuration space by taking appropriate averages over various time intervals and compute this dimensionless ratio, the correlation of the fluctuating velocity fields with the fluctuating magnetic fields normalized by the total energy. And in all the results I'll show here, this is further normalized, so waves propagating outward from the sun always have positive cross-helicity, except for one Ulysses plot that I'll show toward the end. But the sign here is the direction of propagation with respect to the background field. Background field can be the propagating pointed outward from the sun or inward, depending on where you are. As a diagnostic, all of that is taken out, and positive values of cross-helicity indicate outward propagation.
I take it you're unconcerned with any magnetic or hydrodynamic helicity?
I am not unconcerned with it, and I will show you some. Because the other invariant, well, can measure certainly the total energy invariant, can measure the cross-helicity invariant, and Bill Matthews and I showed some time ago that because the solar wind is supersonic and superalphanic, with a single point measurement you can measure the total magnetic helicity. And that's an interesting and useful diagnostic. But since it's almost always zero, it's easy to sort of sum up what what its properties are. But it's very useful when you're talking about waves excited near shocks, because if you know the cross-helicity and you know the magnetic helicity, then you know the plasma physics polarization of the fluctuation, and you know its mode. And if you can measure the distribution function, then you can figure out what instability is generating the fluctuations. And we've done some of that, none of which I'll mention here, except I just mentioned it, but I won't show any of it here. So let me show you some observations of turbulence in the solar wind and some observations of Ulysses of Alphane waves. Show you a spectrum of data that was accumulated over nearly 2 years by mostly by IMP-8, which has been a satellite in Earth orbit since I've been in this profession. It's certainly about 30 years old. It's been going around accumulating data. Ulysses, because it left the heliospheric equator and went up to high latitudes where the wind is only fast, provided some really unique data sets of Alphane waves. And then we'll talk about turbulence. Well, that is the spectrum of IMP data. And it never did project well. I'm kind of afraid to turn this off. But yeah, I think that'll work. If the power book doesn't go to sleep, it'll work. All right, and here's the magnetic helicity spectrum, among other things. So what's shown here is the trace of the power spectral matrix. This is about 600 days of data. Our averages, which is why the spectrum cuts off here at a few times 10 to the minus 4. The spectrum actually goes out to about 10 to the minus 1 hertz and then falls over. So this is just a systematic effect of using hour average data. There is an inertial range, which on this scale, because we use hour average data, you can't really distinguish between minus 5/3 and minus 3/2. I'll show you more discriminating evidence that it's one or the other in a few moments. So this is the power spectral matrix integrated over 2 years, or accumulated over 2 years of data. It has this inertial range, which is 5/3, that extends out to about 10 to the minus 1. So it goes over about 3 or 4 decades, sometimes 5. There is another range, which is the energy containing scale, which is 10 to the minus, this is 10 to the minus 1, k to the minus 1, or f to the minus 1, is f to the minus 5/3. And another regime back here, which has not been studied very much at all, because you need very long time periods to see it. These oscillations are real. They're the 27-day rotation of the sun. So you're seeing co-rotating interaction regions in this region. Okay. Also plotted here is the power in the magnitude of the magnetic field, in green, which also tends to have a spectrum which is more or less the same as the power in the components, tends to be 5/3, a little steeper in this example. And these blue and purple circles and triangles are the magnetic helicity, which you see are generally very far below the power. They're normalized so that if it was purely circular, they would be up at that level. So they're just fluctuating around zero, except maybe at the very largest scales.
Excuse me, blue is helicity. So what is brown that you started? What is the spectrum?
This is the power spectrum of the components of the three vector parts of the magnetic field, radial, tangential, and normal components of the magnetic field. It's a trace of the power spectral matrix of the magnetic field. This is the power in the magnitude of the field, and the circles and triangles are the positive and negative values of the magnetic helicity. Well, one of the things it means is that the fluid is approximately incompressible, that fluctuations in the magnitude of the field tend to be small. They're like 5% of the fluctuations in the waves. And that's true also of the density. Delta N over N tends to be about 5%, unless you're near a shock, you know, then it's 4. But, you know, ordinarily it's small.
So, in other words, the red curve is really just the ordinary power spectrum, right?
The red curve is the ordinary power spectrum, right?
The green curve is...
The green curve is the power in the magnitude of the field, square root of b squared, bx squared plus by squared plus bz squared. Of curious theoretical interest, but it's an easy thing to compute, and it tells you some things about morphology of what's going on.
Do people think the smallness of the green plot to be an indication of shear alphane polarization as opposed to slow mode polarization or pseudo alphane?
Well, slow modes are very strongly damped in the solar wind, and fast modes are damped pretty well as well. So this is mostly taken as an indication that the medium is quasi incompressible. When Ulysses went out of the ecliptic and went through the northern and southern latitudes at about 4 astronomical units, once it got out of the current sheet area, the plasma sheet area, saw just fluctuating alphanic type fluctuations. Blue is outward directed interplanetary field, red is inward-directed interplanetary magnetic field. IMF is not the International Monetary Fund in this context. This is at solar minimum, and here's the streamer belt of the closed magnetic field region. This is a Yoko false color map again, and the other image is one of the LASCO instruments on SOHO. So this is going out to about 3 or 4 solar radii. This is going out to 3 or 4 astronomical units. So the scale is not the same. Actually, this one of these is Mauna Loa, and the other one is LASCO. So. All right, well, here's an example of alphane waves. Anyone who's read anything about solar wind literature probably run across a seminal paper by Belcher and Davis in 1971, where one of the early Mariner interplanetary spacecraft, they noticed that there was this fluctuation in the magnetic field and the velocity field that was highly correlated. They had only one dimension that was done with the normal component of the magnetic field. They didn't have three-dimensional measurements of the plasma. And they noticed this high correlation, which suggested there are alphane waves. And at least until recently, all review papers about alphane waves in the solar wind have only used that example. I began to wonder whether it was the only example. So several years ago, I pulled out a pretty much random set of 2 days worth of Ulysses data, almost random because I had to try twice. The first example I pulled out wasn't quite stationary. to see whether, you know, just how true this was. And since then, others have done similar things. But here's the velocity fluctuations of Ulysses. These are 8-minute average data over 2 days taken when Ulysses was up well away from the central plasma sheet, away from the heliospheric equator. And here are the magnetic field components, the radial, tangential, and normal components of the magnetic field. In Alphane speed units, I didn't bother to rotate this data set into mean field coordinates or try to do anything else with it. The field is not in the radial direction. But nonetheless, if you plot the two on top of each other, there's a really strong correlation, even on the radial component, which is the most susceptible to compressive modes. You can see over there the correlation fails. But everywhere else, it's really remarkably high. And this is not atypical of measurements in the solar wind, as long as you're away from shock waves and other things like that.
When you say Alphane waves, do you mean something more than just high cross-helicity?
No, I mean delta B equals delta B, you know, to some degree.
Right, but that's not necessarily a wave as opposed to a strongly turbulent fluctuation.
Right. I'm using that interchangeably. And I,
how much direct evidence is there for, what is the understanding, if you're going to talk about turbulence, of the inward propagating Alphane component?
Okay.
Which would need to have counter-propagating waves.
Well, that's an interesting point. When Belcher and Davis and Coleman and Unti and Neugebauer first found these Alphane waves, a controversy ensued, as one might expect. If the medium is really incompressible and the fluctuations are really Alphane waves, then there should be no turbulence. So two points of view emerged. One was, all you were seeing was some frozen process reminiscent of the solar corona, that these were pure Alphane waves. Equations that describe their interactions are essentially incompressible ideal MHD. They're exact solutions of the equation. No turbulence. Coleman, however, was really taken by the fact that the power spectrum of these things was 5/3. That looks like turbulence, and there's enough energy in the velocity shears that you see in the solar wind. As you go from slow wind to fast wind, there are velocity shears of a couple of 100 kilometers per second. There's a tremendous amount of energy there, he pointed out. This should be driving a turbulent cascade. And that controversy remained for several years. All these Alphane waves that I've shown are propagating outward. The cross-helicity is all positive. And there is, I'll show an example of inward propagating waves in a bit, but the examples you see in fast wind are outward propagating. Correlations are about 0.8 or 0.9 very often, and it also looks like turbulence. So what is it?
What's the wave number at the end of the energy containment scale?
It goes out to the ion cyclotron scale. So what? And I have an example later on. What one has here is sort of an inertial range of 5/3 that's like four decades. The ion cyclotron scale tends to be right about there.
Yeah. What about the energy containment scale?
The energy containment scale also depends on where you are. As you move inward, and the closest measurements that have been made so far are Helios at 0.3 AU. Almost the entire spectrum is K to the minus 1. So one possible interpretation is that the source of these fluctuations in the solar atmosphere is K to the minus 1. And that is an energy-containing scale that's driving a cascade which proceeds out to the cyclotron scale. And if you're in far, there isn't much room, so you see almost only K to the minus 1, a very small inertial range, and then a dissipation scale.
How about the slow solar wind? You mentioned that you only see outgoing waves in the past.
The slow solar wind looks very much the same, except number one, because it's slower, and number two, because it has more velocity shear, has more time to evolve. So in the slow solar wind, you tend to see less of this and more of that.
This seems such an important point in that, you know, many of your coworkers from your view graph number one are busily trying to explain the spectra in terms of Goldreich, Sridhar, blah, blah, blah.
Or not. Or not.
Or not. But I mean, certainly it is a widely circulating industry. And of course, this requires counterpropagating streams. And it always, so the question one is always tempted to ask is where, you know, what about the counterpropagating element?
Okay.
Well, it would tend to naturally decay away, right? If you had it in at, say, 0.3 AU, the tendency of turbulence is to decay towards higher normalized cross-elasticity.
Well, actually, and I'll show this toward the end, if you get that far, if there is no velocity shear, the Alphane waves don't change. They remain Alphanic out to 9 astronomical units. And I have an example as we go on. So here's some real data from Helios at 0.3 AU. So this is about as far in as you can get, except for interplanetary scintillation measurements, which measure the density, not the magnetic field, so you can't really determine what the power spectrum is any further in than this until solar probe goes. And there's an inertial range out to a tenth of a hertz. And this is also average. This isn't the high-frequency data from Helios, so this spectrum goes out further. And the energy-containing range, and then something. I don't know what.
When you mention by F minus 1, there is any theoretical idea? Because, I mean, you can as well match by any close number, 1.4, 0.4.
Probably. I don't think statistically the minus 1 is very firm. The 5/3 often is. I mean, we've measured spectra over 3 or 4 days. That's like 1.67 plus or minus 0.03. Yeah. But the 1 has not been measured to anything like that statistical accuracy.
Why do you pick this number? Is there any theoretical arguments for this?
Well, there have been a couple. Some years ago, F to the minus 1 looks like a log normal distribution. So motivated by the fact that it's the result of a log normal process, perhaps.
It's a log normal distribution.
If you had a log normal process, you could create an F to the minus 1 spectrum. F to the minus 1 is consistent with log normal statistics. So given that observation, Bill Matthews and I hypothesized that perhaps there was some process like some kind of hierarchy of reconnections in the solar atmosphere that gave rise to the F to the minus 1. Ms. Mikan has suggested maybe some hierarchy of vortical structures is giving rise to the F to the minus 1. And more recently, Marita Briatova has come up with some complex scenario which is at least similarly motivated.
What's the magnetic candle number for all this?
I have no idea. People have tried to estimate it, but there's no good theory for really deriving a magnetic Reynolds number or Prandtl number for this regime. I mean, Dave Montgomery has written a couple of papers on the subject, but I don't know that anybody believes any computed answer for those quantities.
Are they simple functions of the temperature and density, or the magnitude?
Exactly. I think he's asking what is the collisional Prandtl number, not the turbulent.
Okay.
Yeah. It's huge.
Depends where you are.
I don't know what it is. My head.
Okay, I don't know.
I say yesterday.
And the solar wind has no collisions to speak of beyond a solar radius or two.
The mean free path is 1 AU.
The mean free path of protons is 1 AU. The mean free path of electrons sometimes is even bigger than that. And it's less in slow wind. But
viscosity's got to be about 10 to the 19th. And resistivity's got to be about 10 to the 7th.
Say it again. So viscosity is 10 to 19.
Uh-huh.
And diffusivity or resistivity?
Or in about 10 seconds.
So it's pretty high.
Yeah.
To ask the obvious question, if the mean free path is 1 AU, why do you need Why are we speaking in terms of hydrodynamics?
Because it seems to work,
Pat. You think it works.
Well, yes, and we know that it's, you know, it's a fiction.
One can say,
you know, there are wave-particle interactions and they mimic collisions and go through all those, you know, standard rationales for why you can use fluid equations when they're not justified. But, you know, nonetheless, the collisional mean free path is an AU. The wave-particle interaction scattering lengths are much shorter, and whether they really provide a collisional equivalent is, I think, open to argument.
To your statement, though, about when you were looking at the spectra of where the cyclotron frequency was quite suggestive of cyclotron damping becoming important in the story.
It might be. I could talk about that. I took those view graphs out of this talk, but we could find them. Let's go out a little bit in the heliosphere. This is Voyager, or Helios near 1AU, and it's a 5/3 spectrum to a very high approximation. And here's your dissipation range. This is using 0.12 second averages of Mariner 10 data at about a half an AU. And here's where the magnetic helicity is really not random. And these fluctuations are perhaps consistent with Whistler modes. You can't really tell anymore because you don't have plasma measurements. So you can't really know which way the fluctuations are propagating. There's no way to be certain that these fluctuations are propagating outward. But you know they're propagating outward down here, so you assume they're still propagating outward, then the polarization is consistent with Whistler's. And this rollover is real. By the time you get out here, you're at the quantization level of the magnetometer, so this is not real. But the rollover is. And this is real, and the change in sign during this interval probably is a spatial effect, that there was some boundary the spacecraft passed, and we did a dynamic spectrum of this interval, and the sign of the polarization changed sign as the structure went past the spacecraft. So there's the dissipation range. At a half an AU, it's at 1 hertz.
What is the red
here? The red is, the power and the magnitude of the field. So these are, again, quasi-incompressible situations that you have highly alphanic-type stuff, presumably because you don't have the plasma, so you don't know. But the compressions in the field are two orders of magnitude smaller.
So it looks like a little bit correlated to the other stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and notice that it flattens. That's real. That's seen very frequently. And the density spectrum tends to do the same thing. And that's not really understood. Another puzzle. All right, well, in the simulations I'm going to describe, we did the usual thing, solve the time-dependent compressible MHD equations in spherical coordinates or Cartesian coordinates. We have, I don't think there are any results in this talk from the spectral method simulations we've used, either pure spectral or pseudo-spectral for the compressible equations. We do have some pseudo-spectral codes that include the Hall and finite Larmor radius corrections, but none that include the electron pressure gradient. And we sometimes use hyperdissipation and bi-Laplacian terms and nonlinear dissipation operators and all those things, probably none of which I will say anything about, and will concentrate on the flux-corrected transport finite difference simulations in mostly two dimensions. I have some view graphs in three dimensions, if we have time, in either rectangular or spherical coordinates. So the basic situation is we put fast flow in on the top and fast flow in at the bottom and slow flow in the middle. If it's spherical coordinates, then this is r theta or it's xy. These purple lines are pressure balance structures that we can throw in if we wish. the Parker field is included in this calculation in two dimensions, but usually not in three-dimensional runs. The boundary conditions are outflow. It's a supersonic simulation, so the fluid comes in supersonic and superalphanic at, say, the left, and goes out to the right, and then there are outflow boundary conditions in theta and phi, so they're just, once it reaches the boundary, it's just extrapolated out. And the input is either monochromatic alphane waves or wave packets or sometimes other things, but primarily waves or wave packets. We can include the spiral field, and the resolutions are generally about, you know, 100 by 100 by 300 or 1200 by 500 in two dimensions. So here's the situation again, the virtual sun, and
when you say 2D, do you mean 2D axisymmetric or 2D projected in the plane?
2D in R theta or R phi.
Or
R phi, yeah. We've sort of done it both ways. And it's an intrinsically 3D code, so that's why the 5 is there, because there are two ghost cells on either side. So if you 5 is the smallest you can get without having to rewrite it in two dimensions. So we put a current sheet in the middle where the slow flow is. The magnetic field changes sign across this current sheet. Sometimes we just let it sort of change sign. Sometimes we rotate it through the current sheet. It doesn't make a lot of difference. And so the magnetic field is going outward there and inward there. Here's a case that's more or less, it's spherical, but it's pseudo-Cartesian. It only went from some dimensionless radius of 20 to 22. So we put shear layer, the slow wind is in the middle here. So there's a velocity shear layer there, there's a velocity shear layer there. The central current sheet is essentially a velocity shear layer. We wanted to see what the power spectrum looked like. So we show the power spectrum near the inflow where you have just the wave packets. In the fast flow and at the end near the velocity shear layer. And just to, oops, I didn't want to do that. Let's see if that works. So it's a time dependent simulation and things evolve.
What are the Mach numbers?
Mach numbers are about 5,
typically.
I don't remember specifically for this run, but approximately 5. Trying to make it as small as possible to get time to evolve across the domain, but large enough so that the boundary conditions are reasonably well satisfied.
And the field has what kind of structure on the left-hand side?
On the left-hand side, it's a wave packet. It's a DC field that's outward and a DC field that's inward, and then wave packets are put in at the input, and they are convected across and interact in some way. There's the spectrum of the input wave packet, so it's pretty well resolved. There are like 5 wave modes put in, and then the dotted line is a 5/3 spectrum, just to guide the eye. I wouldn't claim that necessarily there's an inertial range with 5/3 there, but and this is the power and the magnitude, and that's the power and the trace.
The color coordinate is what?
It was just something to show what the shear layers look like.
Yeah, well, is it the perpendicular velocity or something?
It's, this one I think is vorticity.
Vorticity,
yeah, it's vorticity.
So what is blue, negative or positive? Do you have any idea?
In this color map, I don't, because I think it's just strong where it's dark. We usually use color maps that distinguish positive and negative, but this one didn't. So it's just strong there.
Well, just the separation between the slow and the fast.
Yeah.
So the wind, so on the outside, it's moving faster.
Right.
So whatever it is, the sign of vorticity, it's jumping from slow to fast.
Yeah.
To the top.
And if you do the same thing in a much more strongly expanding situation, you tend to get much less evolution. Basically, you don't get a cascade that goes out beyond where the highest mode was put in, if the expansion is strong.
Are you truly getting any cascade in this?
No.
But what's the...
Not in this one.
So you have a difference, though, between the top frame on the right and the bottom frame on the right, that's in the slow wind and fast.
Right. The slow wind, you get a little bit of more evolution, but, you know, that's not really a cascade. It doesn't really have any kind of extension to really high frequencies.
So the difference between this...
But here you get nothing.
The difference between this and the previous model is basically...
The geometry, the expansion.
Just the expansion.
Just the expansion. Essentially the same parameters.
Does this have any velocity shear?
It's the same velocity shear, actually.
Is the absence of a cascade just simply if a Fuga thing blows it by you before it can couple to the smallest scale?
I think it's that the expansion is so rapid the transverse scales are increasing on the order of the eddy turnover length. So you just don't have any space to go.
Well, in a fishery, right? Incompressible.
This is compressible.
Yeah, but the larger part of it is still incompressible, right?
Yeah.
And on the right hand side,
yeah,
when you look at it.
It's just Alphane wave packets going in. And,
right, and those shouldn't cascade at all, right?
Yes, they will.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's this example. This is Cartesian. And the pseudo Cartesian, the first one I showed the same thing. I mean, even if you put in pure Alphane waves, they're not pure enough to. They don't stay pure enough to prevent interaction. And we've seen that in the spectral codes. If the cross helicity is 0.9, that's enough. You'll get a strong nonlinear evolution and a cascade with a cross helicity of 0.9 in either the incompressible or the compressible simulations.
They cascade in different ways, though? Yeah,
the speed changes. I mean, the cascade is a little slower when you're at 0.9 than it is at 0.8.
No, I mean between the incompressible and the compressible.
Not that much.
You're still a beta kind of 1-ish?
Yeah. Yeah. Beta tends to be about 1. And here you do get, you know, cascade that went out noticeably further than the input wave packet high frequency. And it's the same, essentially pure, not exactly pure, the cross helicity of each individual wave is like 0.9.
You launch all that as a wave packet on the left-hand side, right? That wave packet consists of right-going and left-going waves. Surely by the time you got to the right-going is separated from the left-going, and now they're no longer...
Well, not quite, because this is supersonic inflow. Everything is propagating outward. All the phases of the initial wave packet are chosen so that the Alphane speed is outward. So the wave packet is propagating as a packet and being convected as a packet and is just interacting nonlinearly as it goes.
But you'd have to have 10% leftward going if you're giving it
100%. Yeah.
Is that generated by the shear? Those shear layers? Are they
90% is what we put in at the inflow.
Is anything generated by the shear boundary?
Yeah.
Do they give you some left going waves?
Yeah.
But if you do the same thing without any shear, then what happens?
Without any shear?
Yeah.
Then nothing happens, or virtually nothing happens.
So it's the coupling of shear.
And that's like this region. This is away from the shear, and virtually nothing happens. And this one is sort of in the slow region near the shear and has much more evolution. And actually, I think I said something incorrect earlier. This other curve is not the magnitude of the field, it's the other Elsasser variable. So this is the measure of the inward propagating modes.
If you look as you go from left to right, does the cross helicity, the normalized cross helicity, increase?
No, it decreases as you go. As you go from left to right, it decreases.
So you're getting more leftward going waves on the right?
Yeah.
So they are
Because there are none here. The inflow, there's nothing.
Okay.
And so it depends where you are. And this is, we do not have a very good way of computing this in this finite difference code. So it's a really crude estimate of the cross-solicity.
And these leftward going waves are generated by the shear lattice?
Primarily.
If one puts in some crude estimate of the sort of Kelvin-Helmholtz excitation there, does it give you some idea of how much leftward going waves? Are they developed by an instability?
Most of the time, these parameters are essentially stable to Kelvin-Helmholtz instability because the velocity jumps are almost supersonic. And although there's strong velocity shear, it's not Kelvin-Helmholtz unstable.
So is the effect of the shear merely refraction and it produces backscatter?
It's in large part. That's a large part of it. Is the refraction. And I think that's a large part of what we'll come to in a moment of what is the symmetry of the of these fluctuations in the solar wind. In this case, we just put in four shear layers just for fun to really stir things up and got a little bit better cascade. But the strong expansion really suppresses things. But I don't know.
That's provided that your input scale is comparable to R.
Yeah.
Okay.
The big major caveat in relating any of this to the solar wind is it's certainly not true in the solar wind that the stuff coming out of the corona has a transverse correlation scale that's that large in latitude. So one could argue that in the real situation, if you have a correlated region that's very small, it's always quasi-Cartesian. So one has to take this with some skepticism.
But in that case, you always expect the cascade.
Right.
Isn't there some reason, like, you have to compare both coherence length to R, but also the expansion speed to the turbulence speed?
Right. Yeah. This plot of the density just meant to illustrate that you do get fast flows overtaking fast slow flows, and you get the sharp color gradients are shock waves. And maybe you'll see that here as well. The vorticity is outlining where the shock wave is, because so we take power spectra in this kind of situation. Again, the inflow shows the wave packet that's input, and if you're near a shear layer, you tend to get some evidence of cascade, but in the expansion, in expanding geometry, it's dramatically suppressed. Sort of summary of the difference, where the expansion is weak, the cascade tends to go out maybe another factor of four, it's of course limited by resolution, and where the expansion is strong, there's essentially no cascade at all. And weak and strong is just whether the expansion distance is comparable or not to an eddy turnover scale. So for expansion time shorter than the nonlinear evolution time, the 1D power spectra relaxes to something sort of like a 5/3 spectrum. With little or no cascade to frequencies except for that, to high frequencies except for that initially present. The curious thing is that in all these simulations, you put in a white noise spectrum and it relaxes to something like 5/3, even if there's no cascade. I don't understand that. And for expansion times that are longer than nonlinear evolution time, the spectra do cascade to higher frequencies. That's especially true in Cartesian or near Cartesian geometries.
This shows three things. The effects of velocity shear on cross-helicity. This is Helios data near 3/10 of an AU. Here's the solar wind speed going from about 400 kilometers per second to like 250 kilometers per second and back up. And the cross-helicity, which is near 1, the red oscillations are high time resolution averages, and the blue is averaged over maybe 15 minutes or so. Cross-helicity is near 1, except when you're near the sharp gradients in the velocity and the center of the heliospheric current sheet where the radial magnetic field is changing sign, then the cross-helicity essentially goes to 0. In a 2D incompressible simulation, saw exactly, you know, pretty much the same phenomenon. The magnetic field change sign, the cross-helicity go to 0 near the place where the magnetic field change sign, where the velocity gradients were larger. In this confused plot of the 2D compressible spectral simulation, essentially the same thing happened. The cross-helicity, which it's hard to see as PowerPoint renders this, goes to 0 here, and the magnetic field is changing sign in the same place, and the velocity gradients are strongest there as well. The 3D simulation showed essentially the same effect, where the magnetic field changed sign, and the cross-helicity went to essentially 0, which perhaps suggests you don't have to do three-dimensional simulations if all you want to know is how velocity affects cross-helicity. All right, here's an example of Voyager data near 8 astronomical units. What's plotted here is the magnitude of the magnetic field, the solar wind speed, this is all pretty high-speed flow, and the cross-helicity at various scales. You don't have to worry about all the scales here, but it's like 15-minute averages or so. And what we see is at 8 AU, the cross-helicity is essentially, over some scales, 0. There are lots of places where it's small and positive, and other places where it's small and negative. So you have plenty of inward propagating fluctuations. They're not really Alfvén waves. The cross-helicity is far from being 1.
Sorry, what do you mean? This is the net cross-helicity, right?
This is the cross-helicity averaged over some time scale, like 3-minute averages.
It could be Alfvén waves going in both directions.
When it's zero, it could be a linearly polarized thing, it could be non-Alfvénic, or it could be equal populations going forward and backwards, right? But in any event, it's not pure outward-going Alfvén waves. Absolutely. Y.C. Wang and Len Berlaga modeled this period. It's totally independent of this analysis, and because they were interested in what kind of flow regimes Voyager was in as it approached Saturn. And what their model showed was for this period, there was a packet of plasma that had never been near the velocity shear regime that separates slow and fast wind. No solar events had gone through it. It was not shocked. It just coasted out from its observation originally on Helios. It's picked up at 1 AU on IMP and then found again in Voyager at 8 AU. That parcel is this period. And the cross-helicity is back up near 0.8. So if there's no velocity shear, Alfvén waves essentially don't decay. They don't interact very strongly in the absence of shear.
What role does the current sheet play in the generation of cross-helicity?
It seems to play an important one because, first of all, the magnetic field magnitude decreases by factors of 2 or more. And secondly, the field tends to rotate in the azimuthal direction. Both of those effects reduce the stabilizing influence of the magnetic field against velocity shear instability, like Kelvin-Helmholtz. So you're much more likely to get strong evolution in the current sheet than even at the strong velocity shear regimes.
so it's stable to if you didn't put in the fluctuation at the left hand side, basically you wouldn't get it.
Basically, that's right. Yeah, and certainly in the spectral simulations, where you just start with some initial distribution, if you just put in pure Alfvén waves, nothing happens. You just waste a lot of computer time, and it just decays depending on what the Reynolds number you put in was.
Wait, if you do
a spectral simulation, and you just put in pure Alfvén waves initially, and let it go. Yeah,
unidirectional.
Or put in no Alfvén waves and shear, yeah, because it's a, you know, if it's supersonic jumps, so it's KH stable, then it won't evolve appreciably. We haven't actually done that one, but we have studied the KH instability recently, and I'll show you a preprint on that later. Okay, I said that. So, what are the symmetry properties of this? And I could stop any time, but I've been going for an hour, so.
So no one to stop.
Okay, people. All right, but when you get bored or wake up from your nap, let me know, and I'll stop. But this, I think, is an important issue, which is not well understood. From single point measurement, you don't know what the symmetry properties are. They're Alfvén waves, but they need not be parallel propagating planar fluctuations. Or they're Alfvénic fluctuations, but they need not be planar and parallel propagating. There have been several attempts to determine what the symmetries of these fields are, and the first of these was an attempt that Bill Matthews and I embarked on many years ago, and it took much longer than we thought it would, and it was a frustrating exercise, but it did yield some results. Our goal was to get a three-dimensional power spectrum. The best we could do was a two-dimensional correlation function. At which point Bill said, "This has taken more time than my PhD thesis. I don't want to do it anymore." So we stopped.
That took 1 year.
This took several years. This took his postdoc and after his postdoc, and we're still playing with it. So what we did here was said, okay, let's assume that the fluctuations of the interplanetary medium are a random stationary process. So the first thing we did was, oh, there's a test for that in Yaglom and Panchev. You can test whether the fluctuations you're measuring constitute a random stationary process. So we did that. That took a while to invent how to actually compute that. And basically what it amounted to was showing that the variance of the fluctuations in the magnetic field over some time interval, as you increase the time interval, decrease like 1 over the correlation time to whatever sample length you had chosen. And I don't think I've got a view graph of that here, but in fact one can construct that test, and it's a zero free parameter test. There's no normalization. It either works or it doesn't. And we had to modify the theory to account for the solar rotation because that affects the variance. And it's right on. So a year's worth or 2 years' worth of interplanetary fluctuation data, you can find samples ranging from 15 minutes to the better part of a day, which are stationary in the statistical sense. Okay, so having done that, we said, okay, let's form an ensemble of all intervals which are stationary and keep track of where the direction of the magnetic field is. So as the mean magnetic field direction changes, you get a different sampling of the three-dimensional power spectrum, because if the field is radial, you're sampling the k-parallel modes. If the field is transverse, you're sampling the k-perp modes. So if this interplanetary magnetic field happened to fill all of azimuthal and vertical space over some time period, you'd have a sample of the 3D correlation function or power spectrum of interplanetary fluctuations. So we did that for about a year's worth of IC3 data. There are two catches. The biggest catch is the solar wind mean magnetic field is hardly ever far out of the ecliptic. So you have almost no hope of getting the third dimension. But it does vary quite a bit in azimuth. A lot of that happens to be the difference between fast streams and slow streams. Our assumption was they're members of the same statistical ensemble. Not only is each element of this ensemble stationary, but they're all elements of the same statistical ensemble. And that, we recognize, was a pretty big assumption, because the slow wind is evolving more rapidly than the fast wind and has different drivers. But nonetheless, that was the assumption we made. Doing that, we then constructed a two-dimensional correlation function. If the solar wind fluctuations were pure Alfvén waves, you'd expect all of the contours of the correlation function to be parallel to the R perp line. And a lot of them are. But if they were, say, quasi-two-dimensional turbulence, or highly refracted Alfvén waves, or whatever, then they would be vertical. And some of them are. So it included that the interplanetary fluctuations seem to consist of two populations, planar Alfvén waves and what we called then quasi-two-dimensional turbulence, motivated by Strauss's work on reduced MHD. Whether that interpretation is really correct or not, I'm not so sure, but there certainly are two components there. And some other techniques have been developed by Bill Matthews and John Bieber and some others who come up with similar conclusions. Their conclusion is, if you had slab waves, you'd only have K parallel. If you had quasi-two-dimensional, delta B and delta K are both perp to B naught. And you could have perpendicular structures where everything's a function of K naught, but is aligned along the mean field. So this is a model calculation that was published in PhysRev Letters by Bill Matthews a few years ago, showing if you had planar Alfvén waves and you had a flux tube, the flux tube would remain coherent as you move down the volume. But as you increase the amount of quasi-two-dimensionality in the statistics of the fluctuations, the field lines would random walk. And his analysis of interplanetary data, and others have come to similar conclusions, is that something on the order of 78% of the fluctuations in the solar wind are quasi-two-dimensional. Well, if they're really quasi-two-dimensional, field lines should be stochastic. However, if you look at scatter-free electron events, and this is radio observations of Ulysses, you find that the type 3 radio bursts follow the spiral magnetic field over several astronomical units. These field lines are not stochastic.
What exactly do you mean by quasi-2D?
What I mean is delta B and delta K are both perpendicular to B naught.
Delta B and K.
Delta B, and K. Delta, and K. Not delta. Delta B and K, perpendicular to B naught.
So, very high K perp.
Very high K perp, mirror modes.
Could you explain how these measurements are taken and what exactly is being measured in this?
Yeah, what is. Ulysses is up out of the ecliptic and it's got a radio receiver and it sees type 3 radio bursts. And you can see where the centroid of the emission is as the type 3 frequency drifts down. And if you have a model, you know the density falls off approximately 1 over r squared, and you also have some ground truth at 1 AU from other spacecraft to tell you what the density is. So given the density model and an observation of how the frequency varies in time, and because spacecraft spins a little bit, you can tell where the centroid of emission is, so you can trace it as it goes out.
And they don't. You can also see how wide it is.
Yeah.
It's pretty packed.
Yeah.
So the B lines can be stochastic on a smaller scale.
On a smaller, they can be, certainly. Yeah, they can be. This is not a counterexample.
I was just to counterbase the same point of the Parker spiral is in some sense the mean field.
Yeah.
Right. So what's the delta B over B?
Well, it gets to be order one when you get out to 3 or 4 AU. But it's still the mean field.
Yes.
But it doesn't really get to be order one. It doesn't really get to be much larger than it is at 1 AU. In fact, it's like, still like 0.3 or something.
In tandem with this exercise of mapping coherence, don't anyone just simply take a realization from one of these simulations and try to calculate a Lyapunov exponent for the field lines?
I don't know. Phil may have.
Exponentiates.
Yeah, Phil may have done that. I don't know. There's another observation on the anomalous the Advanced Composition Explorer, which is at one astronomical unit, of measuring 07 and 06 plus in the solar wind as different field line regions pass by and the populations change very abruptly, suggesting that whatever's going on within a flux tube, at least the boundaries between flux tubes, remain distinct.
Is that a controversial point? Like I had heard that there's some recent studies by Jacobi which are pushing the alternate viewpoint that you have significant cross-field diffusion.
Yeah, Randy has been saying recently that his models require significant cross-field diffusion. I don't think he wants to get as much as the quasi-two-dimensional model of the interplanetary field would require, but he's talking about K parallel or K purpose like 0.1, whereas normal quasi-linear theory would give you something like 0.01. So it's large, but it's not this large. Okay, but there are lots of other possibilities for large K perp modes, aside from quasi-two-dimensional turbulence, which may be the same thing as mirror modes at different scales, because they have the same property. But in all of these observations, even Ulysses in almost pure, fast solar wind at high latitude, there are small velocity fluctuations on the order of 20 or 30 or 40 kilometers per second. And if you had a planar wave going over a couple of astronomical units in a velocity shear that's 30 or 40 kilometers per second, that wave is going to get refracted. And that's going to produce a significant K-perp. Whether that's the origin of this seeming quasi-two-dimensionality, I don't know. But it's something we're trying to ascertain. Okay. I think I'll stop here.
Latitude magnetic field in the solar wind showing it reversing between the current solar cycle and the previous solar cycle, the direction of the radial field in the solar wind.
Say that again.
Is there any Ulysses measurement, recent Ulysses measurements of the high latitude solar wind magnetic field? Indicating that the direction of that magnetic field, the high latitudes, has changed since the last solar cycle?
I suspect there is. I don't remember exactly where Ulysses is now, but if you look at Carrington rotation maps from last May through now, you can see the reversal of the magnetic field, and it started around May of 1999. And it's been very dramatic since. And Ulysses must be seeing that, but I haven't seen the recent data.
Could you say a little bit more about what you mean about the power spectrum relaxing without
cascade to apply for? Well, all I can say is every time we run one of these simulations, even in a strongly expanding flow where there is no cascade in the sense that we never see frequencies that are higher than the highest one we put in, the spectrum relaxes. And we're far away from the dissipation scale of the numerics. So it's not a numerical dissipation, I don't think. We put in a white noise spectrum like this, and it ends up like that.
The cutoff doesn't change.
Cutoff doesn't change.
It just seems bigger.
So you get a redistribution without going out to
right,
the high.
Right.
Does the low end go up? Or just every quarter?
Quantitatively, I don't really know. It wouldn't have to go up much, to be hidden. because I've only looked at it on log plots, which really doesn't address that question. I don't think it goes up, but that's a good thing to look at.
I mean, is this a redistribution, or are you losing some down the bottom?
I don't think we're losing very much down the bottom, but you need about... Tried putting in some cases where the way pack really didn't go out very far, so the numerical dissipation would be essentially zero. And it still see the same relaxation.
How did you define ARPERP and ARPARLL in the Matisse Cross plot?
Parallel or perp to the mean magnetic field during the time interval that element of the ensemble was constructed. So if the field was stationary over 15 minutes, our parallel and our perp is defined with respect to the magnetic field direction during that 15-minute interval.
Okay. Do rotation discontinuity play much of a role? Are they very important to determine the spectrum?
Well, if there are a lot of them, they'll probably produce a 1/f² spectrum.
But you don't see.
We don't see much of that.
Either in the data or in your system.
Yeah. And basically, when we first did this kind of analysis in 1982, we either looked for periods that had no shocks or no discontinuities or lots of them, figuring that was also statistically stationary. So we didn't care whether they were there or not, just we didn't want one or two. So we either wanted none or many. And rotational discontinuities aren't all that frequent compared with alphanic fluctuations. And they're also alphanic, by and large.
What is the Goldberg treatise fit into this?
I have no idea.